Hello, and welcome to the Employee Safety Podcast from Alert Media, where you'll hear advice from experienced industry leaders on how to protect your people and business. I'm Peter Steinfeld. Today, we're joined by Dr. Atiyah Martin, a nationally recognized resilience expert with over 20 years' experience in emergency management, public health preparedness, and organizational leadership. Dr. Martin is the CEO and founder of All Aces Incorporated, a consulting firm focused on facilitating resilient workplaces. In this episode, Dr. Martin explores what organizational resilience looks like in today's complex risk environment, breaks down where companies often fall short, and shares what leaders can do today to build stronger, more adaptive systems. Let's listen in. Hey, Dr. Martin, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me, Peter. I appreciate you.
Well, let's jump right into it. Something that's changed a lot since 9/11 and Katrina is the concept of organizational resilience. What do you think organizational resilience really means in today's risk landscape?
So there's two parts to that. One is the simple, very short answer, which is collective action for thriving. But what that means in practice is that in organizations that we're not just looking at how we stand up for emergencies and disasters. We're not just looking at the traditional types of plans and structures, that we're incorporating considerations for the realities of our organizations on a day-to-day basis. That's the opportunity that resilience brings. Our organizations operate a certain way every day. And whatever challenges we have every day in the organization are the challenges that are going to be exponentially worsened when we're dealing with crisis. So the more that we can understand that, the better we can really strengthen our resilience and leverage moments of difficulty and crisis and challenge to strengthen our organizations.
Well, I think you alluded to it there, but organizations really operate at different maturity levels. But are there any patterns that you see in how they define and implement resilience?
Absolutely. To your point around resilience, oftentimes people think of it as an outcome, as a place you arrive, when in reality, it's a process. And the process that we're going through is building and strengthening capabilities. So when we talk about a spectrum of resilience, we're talking about at the lowest level, being able to just survive, like we still exist. And at the highest levels, we're able to really transform what a lot of the researchers call transformative resilience, where we're able to maximize these moments to improve ourselves. And on the psychological resilience side of the house, they call that post-traumatic growth. So our ability to really tap into our core strengths, make sure that what we're doing aligns with our organizational strategy, and that we're able to hold on to ourselves while we're navigating the difficult societal environment.
And to the point you made before, if you're misaligned on something, when things are going well, it's bad. But when a disaster happens, it's exponentially worse.
Exponentially. Thank you for naming that. And I think the other common misconception about resilience is that it is the same thing as preparedness or business continuity or security operations, like that they're somehow one in the same, but they're not.
How do you think they differ?
Well, they differ because resilience really is more about striving for operational excellence, but with this very clear connection to big picture strategy, with this very clear connection to what it is that we do every single day, our operations, and how that plays into what we do when we are standing up these different systems to deal with these moments that we're planning for. It is this very unique opportunity to be intentional about growth and developing our ability to adapt, to strengthen our core capabilities, to strengthen our employees' core capabilities so that they can play a more meaningful role in the work that we're doing. And that's where the opportunity for justice comes in, organizational justice, as a part of this concept of organizational resilience. And here's why that's important and why it is another part of separating it from the traditional ways we think about business continuity or emergency management. It's this component of getting people involved in things that involve them. Very straightforward. But the organizational justice research is very clear that when we have procedural justice, meaning that we have representation in decisions that we're making across the range of folks in our organizations, whether it's senior leadership managers and employees, different functional groups, all the different ways we think about it, including different demographics within the organization. When we are able to have accuracy in the information that we're leveraging as a part of processes to make decisions, when we have the ability to have ethicality, that we're incorporating what we claim to stand for into the decisions, into the processes of how we make decisions, and then correctability. How can we make sure that when we are not our best selves and we make a decision through a process that causes harm, that there's a way to correct it, that there's a redress that employees, that partners have as we are working towards improving ourselves, that continuous improvement process that many people talk about. The last two pieces I'll mention here around this organizational justice concept are related to what they call interactional justice. That's a combination of interpersonal justice, how people are treated within processes. And I know we're in a rush and we're always trying to go, go, go. But the reality is the way that employees and external partners and our boards and everyone else, the communities that we're a part of, judge if a process is fair is all of those things that are associated with procedural justice, but it's also how was I treated in this process? And then the other part of interactional justice is informational justice. Did you provide quality information to the people who are part of the decision-making process in a timely fashion, in plain language, so that folks can actually understand what it is that we're really talking about, and that they were provided all of the information in a truthful way, that there's no omission or commission as a part of the information. The third component is really about distributive justice, which when we talk about distributive justice, now we're talking about how we distribute the resources as a part of the process, as well as the outcome. So that's all kind of conceptual, but what happens in real life is that oftentimes there's context that we never have unless we ask. So in order for us to make the best decisions possible, we need to have that best context possible. And that requires these forms of justice to be a part of the decisions that we make, how we put our plans together, and how we ultimately build capabilities and determine the pathway forward for improving ourselves.
So it seems like, based on what you said, that operational resilience really is a daily operational mindset and an empowerment. So whatever employee in the organization, be it the lowest employee or the CEO and anyone in between, is just able to respond to what's thrown at them that day. It's not like it's all good days and everything's good and then, oh my gosh, I got to be trained for how to deal with the bad day. It's like no matter what comes at you, you should be equipped day in and day out to deal with it.
Exactly. It's really about building capabilities and going back to the basics. So in emergency management, there's this concept that I adore, and it's in like a nerdy adore, called POETI. And I apply it to so many different contexts because it's so powerful. It is literally step by step. This is how you build a capability. Number one, we have to have a plan in place. So we have to develop plans for the goal, the objectives that we're trying to accomplish. And they have to be clear, plain language, operationally aligned with reality, and collaboratively done. In order for those plans to work, we have to have the organizational structures in place day to day and post-disaster or post-crisis. That organizational structure has to have all those layers of justice in there so that we are maximizing our talent and impact. We need to equip people with what they need in order to execute on the plan and apply that organizational structure. Everyone will then need to be trained on all of these resources, on the organizational structure, on the plans, and why we're ultimately trying to do these things. And last but not least is exercise and evaluation. that we are testing to make sure that all the stuff actually works, that we are able to accomplish that ultimate strategic goal instead of supporting goals in a meaningful way, and that we're doing it in a responsible way.
Now, everything you just said requires a lot of effort. Just in your experience, do you find that it's management that tends to not want to put the effort in, or is it the employees that don't, or is it an equal challenge when you go into an organization?
This is going to sound like I'm dodging the question. It depends. It depends. And here's what it depends on. So every organization has its own dynamics, but it depends on who is pushing for change. If it's senior leadership, you have a better chance of success as long as they are skilled at change management. If it's coming from the management level, it's a bit of a harder sell. And oftentimes that level of pushing for change requires them to model what it looks like for people to see what's possible. If it's coming from employees, that is the hardest because you have to organize. You have a larger base of folks to coordinate amongst in order to arrive at some collective agreement on what we're striving for. And then you have to convince senior leadership and management that what was being proposed is going to work. And a lot of times what it requires is a commitment from the employees to be partners with managers and senior leadership to move things forward. So for all change, it requires a heavy lift on whoever is the initiator. Ultimately, the reason why this work is so hard is because people default for what they know and what they're comfortable with, even if the alternative is obviously better.
Yeah, it seems like no matter what the material is, it really comes down to change management. So that's a big part of this. So folks that are listening really should think, what can I do to become a better change agent?
Exactly. And I think the consideration for being a change agent really is, what are you willing to risk? Because you're making yourself vulnerable. And I know people are like, vulnerability is great. Yes, and you have to be intentional about what you're making yourself vulnerable to. Are you risking your job? Are you risking a promotion? Are you risking something else? But being clear about what you're willing to risk so that you can develop a strategy that matches.
Well, speaking of risks, how do environmental factors like severe weather or transportation shutdowns impact organizational resilience?
It impacts it in several ways. Some of them are common and some of them will be unique to the organization. But when we are experiencing something like severe weather where there's a transportation shutdown, it really is something that we can project ahead of time. So this isn't unfathomable that these things could happen. So in an ideal world, we are able to see, are our planning assumptions aligned with how this particular situation played out? And what can we shift or adjust? And I'll give a concrete example. We did some work for a social and an infrastructure vulnerability assessment. And we had 70 private sector managers, infrastructure managers, from healthcare to transportation to the whole range of sectors who could potentially be impacted by a major disaster. In this context, it was a coastal storm that was going to create all kinds of cascading impacts. And when we were debriefing from the tabletop exercise we did with the group, what was fascinating is I asked the group a question that I assumed that it was a simple question. And the question I asked was, for you all who are playing this kind of emergency management role in your organization or in your institution, how closely are you working with your HR department? Do you know where your employees live? Is it mapped out so that you can understand the distribution of your employees and which of your employees are potentially going to disproportionately be burdened by something like a transportation shutdown? How are you going to make sure that those employees are able to get to you? What are the plans in place? And if you understand where they're distributed, then you can have more intentional expectations for who's going to be able to show up without support and who will not be able to, and what you can then do proactively to address those challenges. And this speaks to the justice principles as well, this idea of understanding the context of your employees' realities. It impacts the day-to-day operations, and it impacts when there are these disasters or breakdowns in the infrastructure that we depend on. I was in a situation where the police department was trying to be helpful to the public health and healthcare infrastructure during a major shutdown of transportation because of weather in the area I was in at the time. And they proposed, without coordinating with the public health response folks, that they're willing to help nurses and doctors get to the hospitals, which on the surface sounds amazing. However, the hospitals are deeply dependent on a massive group of staff who are disproportionately impacted by transportation inequities. If you think about the operations of something like a hospital, you're talking about the people who keep it clean and sanitized so that sensitive procedures can be completed. You're talking about making sure that the patients get fed. You're talking about the folks who transport patients all around the hospitals. It was the employees who were the engine of the operations who needed support. And so it's a common misconception that the people who are most visible and have the most status that folks that think of as needing support when we're often talking about infrastructure in different organizations and what are the priorities for who we should be focusing our energy on.
You know, that's really interesting. Those priorities and perhaps the internal dynamics of an organization can lead people down the wrong path. So what are some of the internal dynamics that you're aware of that can weaken an organization's resilience journey?
The biggest challenge is when an organization doesn't have a clear strategy and doesn't have clear operational processes. So when people are not clear about what the ultimate objectives and goals are, they have this narrow perspective of almost like a checklist approach to what their role is in the organization. It makes it hard to feel connected to the everyday organization and is missing an important part of the employee experience, which is purpose. Like, I'm connected to the ultimate purpose and mission of this organization. The second part that I mentioned was the operational processes. When an organization isn't clear about why it does what it does and what are the steps to perform each function on a day-to-day basis, it's really hard to translate that into post-incident priorities. And if from a resilience perspective, it's really hard to translate that into transformative resilience post-disaster or that post-traumatic growth concept that I was mentioning, because you can't improve something that you don't fully understand.
And I love what you led off with there, which is that idea of leadership really leaning into making sure people understand what is the mission of what we're trying to accomplish here. Because when an emergency happens, things aren't normal. The average person out there doing their job knows what to do most of the time, and probably especially when something goes wrong, as long as they have that light to look toward, like, this is what I need to do, and oh, today I have to do it a little bit differently. But they're going to be able to execute on that if they understand what direction they're supposed to march in.
An important part of the strategic direction of an organization, which is oftentimes fluff in most organizations, unfortunately, is our values and principles. Because if they're done well and aligned with the organization's mission and long-term vision, then they actually answer some important questions during times of uncertainty.
Yes.
So our values, not just the words of integrity and, you know, those types of things, but how do you translate those values into principles that folks can apply when they're confronted with choices so that they don't have to run everything up the flagpole. They know that in this moment, we are an organization that prioritizes human beings. And if given the choice between making a decision that is about investing in something that might be harmful to people, then I know, you know what, we're not going to do that because we have an explicit principle that says this is how you make that choice. So the values that translate into principles really help us to operationalize our strategy in a powerful way that gives authority and autonomy to people at the lowest possible levels to execute on our strategy, whether it's day-to-day operations or post-disaster.
Well, in your experience, how common is it for organizations to take a step back and realize their resilience gaps in hindsight?
Not often, Peter. However, it's not the actually human thing to do. It requires intentionality, a plan, a commitment to looking at what we're doing and being able to criticize ourselves, to critique ourselves. And we don't really like to do that. It goes against the human brain. However, for organizations where I've seen really amazing continuous improvement towards resilience, it really has been this work around how do we measure what we're doing? And when we think about measuring things, oftentimes people think of KPIs, key performance indicators. Usually, the measures that we choose are things that we cannot influence by the time we get the numbers. Those are lagging measures, and they're important. And we should know what those are because that aligns with our strategy and our principles, all that good stuff. However, in order to achieve what we want to achieve for our lagging measures, we need leading measures. So those things that we can pay attention to on a weekly, monthly, quarterly basis that give us some insight into whether or not we're on the right track. So there's a level of pulse checking with employees and making sure that we're analyzing that data on a regular basis and disaggregating it by different levels of the organization, by different demographics, so we can see the variances. Because oftentimes those lagging measures are a big picture, and it's through the disaggregation of data that you really find where there are opportunities for improvement.
So it seems like that's a big role of leadership, is just to step back each day and say, where do we stink? Like, where are we just not doing a good job? And then just slowly but surely, day in and day out, just whittling away at it and getting better at those individual things.
Exactly. And to be honest, sometimes it can sting, but the best source of intelligence on that is from our employees. Sometimes people don't fully understand the amount of intelligence that people at the lowest levels of the organization have about what works and what doesn't work. And so being able to harness that collective intelligence into wisdom that can inform our decision-making processes.
So what's one actionable step a corporate leader could take back to their organization today to maybe help improve resilience?
One actionable step that a leader can take today, realistically, is to work on their personal and professional development. Make sure that you understand as a leader your own strengths and challenges. And if we have the humility to accept that, then they create the space for us to lead this work well, do it with not just integrity and intentions, but in an intentional way where we're holding ourselves accountable and we're able to lead other people in a way that contributes to our resilience. But collective resilience, organizational resilience, is predicated on our leadership resilience. Our resilience as a person to show up every day and be our best selves.
Well, before we wrap up, are you working on any new projects or initiatives that you'd like to share with our listeners?
Yes. So excited. We have an online platform called intentionallyact.com where we have dismantled the traditional way of thinking about education and training and went straight for here are the key principles you need to understand in a digestible way. And now let's practice. So we have a number of opportunities where we're leveraging technology and AI to help people practice the skills that they need in order to be successful in leading resilient and just organizations.
Excellent. Well, that's all going to be super helpful. And Dr. Martin, thank you so much for being on the show today. I thought it was a great conversation.
You are wonderful, Peter. Thank you so much. Appreciate you.
To learn more about Dr. Martin and her work in organizational resilience, click the links in the episode description. You can also watch the video highlights on Alert Media's YouTube. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review the show wherever you get your podcasts. Stay safe out there.
Thank you for listening to the Employee Safety Podcast from Alert Media, the industry's most intuitive emergency communication and threat intelligence solution. To learn more about how to protect your people and business during critical events, visit alertmedia.com. Until next time.